Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kim. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 293, recorded May 2nd, 2016.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Hey, guys.
So, who do we have on the show today?
We have Mick in the one and only Carnforth, UK. Tony in Evansville, Indiana.
He's a new one.
A new one. And Juliet in Paris, France.
Excellent. Well, let us begin without preamble.
I don't know if anybody would get that quote if I said that quote.
Which one?
That was a new one.
Oh, I would.
You would. If anybody gets that one, then you're really cool and you can have 3 points.
Okay, I was going to say it, but now I'm not. Okay.
Yes. I would give them points respectfully. That's another one from the same thing. Okay, I'm done. Sorry, guys. Okay, Mick, he says, hi, guys. Apologies for not posting the video of the Blackmore fry. I got the camera and was all set to shoot when I realized that the memory card was missing. I think we put it in our shop CCTV camera and forgot to replace it. We'll correct this ASAP.
We will look forward to seeing those videos of the Blackmore fry.
In other news, I was wondering if you had any experience of Pleiades and swords fin-nipping each other. I brought 3 female blue Mickey Mouse Pleiades home to drop fry in a breeding tank. I also bought 3 female and 1 male swordtails home and set them up in another tank. Both groups were really bad for nipping each other's fins, with one sword having the whole of the dorsal taken off. After a few weeks, they have stopped doing it and fins have all healed up, but I have not had this happen in the past and wonder if it is some kind of bizarre stress reaction. They weren't in tanks with any other fish, and only the swords had a male in with them. Any ideas appreciated?
That is quite strange. I can't recall having seen that before. I've kept Pleiades, or Pleiades, depending on how you say it, pretty extensively for a number of years.
None of them ever bugged each other?
Not that I can recall. And I've also had sword tails, although it's been even longer since I've had sword tails. But I don't remember having seen that. Are any other Aquarimaxers out there having similar issues, or have you had similar issues? And it sounds like it was a temporary issue. I do remember seeing live bears kind of face off and nip at each other a little bit, but it never resulted in anything visible that I can remember. No fin damage or anything. They just kind of nipped at each other and faced off and then left. So, haven't seen that. Interesting.
Any ideas?
Well, I'm glad they have all healed up. I mean, it kind of makes sense that it could have been something, maybe a little bit more aggression due to some stress. That sometimes happens, but I've never seen anything quite like that. And since they're all healed up, that's good, but it's something, apparently whatever was the causative agent or causative situation isn't there anymore, so that's really strange. Have to mold that one over a bit and hope that some Aquarimaxers out there can tune in with some insights.
Okay. Do Tony in Evansville, Indiana?
Yes. He's the new contributor. I believe we've had contributors from Indiana before, but not this Tony. And it incidentally reminds me that Pet Fish Talk used to have a regular contributor from Evansville, Indiana, I think.
Oh, really?
Jay.
Oh.
From Evansville, Indiana.
That's funny.
So,
yeah. He says, hey, Russ and Kelly, I started listening to you all a couple months ago, and I'm about 10 pages deep into your podcast. I really enjoy the show, and I'm glad you have all decided to keep it up. I started a fluval spec V with a... I started a fluval spec 5 with a dwarf puffer, and have been having a great time with it. It has frog bit that is overperforming and just looks naturally rivery-ish. There's no place for a picture on the contact page, but if you'd like an email one, so you can...
Oh, he did.
You did? Okay.
He did email some. I'll have to show you that one up. Yeah.
I'm new to the hobby, and the spec is my first tank. I've done a lot of reading, listening, and watching, and I'd like to try my hand at breeding guppies. I mainly want to gift them to folks wanting to get into the hobby, local enthusiasts, etc. I don't care to make any money off of it, but I thought it would be really fun to make my own strain. I know there are a million types of colors, etc., but I'd like for people to say, oh, you have some of Tony's guppies? Any ideas on what types to cross or how to achieve a consistent strain? This may be too deep a discussion for the show, but I'd like any input you may have. Well, you... Oh, it says, thanks for all you do, guys. Keep it up. You had your own colony of guppies going for... how many years?
Many years.
That you crossed and kept various traits, and you had the leopard spots that you kept for a long time.
I played around with some interesting guppy things for a long time, and I enjoyed it, but there were some difficulties inherent in it. And so I think I can give some, hopefully, a little bit of basic info there about that. I wanted to pull up Tony's pictures really quickly here.
You gonna show me?
Yeah, these are some photos of his tank.
As you guys know, I never see them ahead of time, and I'm reading everything cold because it's more exciting.
Right? Well, the tank does look rivery-ish, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's cool.
I like how the frog bit's doing, and I like the branches, the driftwood there.
Of course, we'll put them up for you.
And I have had dwarf puffers. Maybe you've heard that in some of the older podcasts. But I have a fondness for dwarf puffers. They're fun fish. A lot of personality per unit volume, or whatever you want to say. They pack a lot for such a small package. It's kind of fun. I love the way that they size you up and seem to be have some sort of imperious air to them, I think.
And eat they're snails fun. Like a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, and that's also fun. They're very predatory. Great for getting rid of amphipods. If you have a tank, like a planted tank infested with amphipods, they're great for that too. Which is originally why I got the first one. Worked like a charm. All right, so let's talk a little bit about breeding guppies. So I would say, first of all, hopefully you have already looked into this. It sounds like you've been researching a little bit, but I think this would be a benefit for other aquariumaxers out there who might be interested in doing something like this. Now, with guppies, you have to keep them separate if you want to do any selective breeding. If you want to do breeding, you don't have to keep them separate. If you want to do selective breeding, then you do. So basically what you need to do is isolate a female before she gives birth, and there are different schools of thought on that, but about exactly when to do it. If you should do it a couple of weeks before she's going to give birth so that she doesn't get upset when you move her, or you just move her right when she's getting birth. There's a couple of different ways to think about that. At any rate, you isolate the female so that the babies are born away from any males outside of the community, and then you can remove the female, and you have to start raising these babies, and as soon as you detect development, a male that's starting to develop, you need to remove that fish to a different tank. And you can put all the males together in one tank from this batch of babies, and all the females together in another tank. Any fish that you're not sure about should be kept in the tank with the males. And the way you can detect this, even when they're quite young and before they start to color up very much, you can see that the gonopodium, or the anal fin, the rays begin to thicken, and the male will start to carry it a little bit more differently, kind of flatten it out a little bit, and it will start to thicken and change shape. And any indication of that, and that fish needs to go in the male tank, because male guppies can... Well, female guppies can be impregnated when they're quite young. And male guppies, as soon as they are recognizably male, or very shortly thereafter, are able to impregnate the females. And of course, one male in a tank full of females will get them all pregnant. So you need to make sure that if you're not sure about a fish, it's in the male tank, and then you don't use that fish for breeding because, you know, you don't know which male it's mated with. Once the females are all adults, and you have a good idea of which ones you want to breed based on particular traits, then you can select the best males. And there are lots of characteristics you want to look for. And, you know, you want a robust, healthy fish. You want a fish with nice size, of course, good coloration pattern, all these things. So that's going to vary a lot depending on which particular traits you're looking for. But, of course, you want fish that are robust and healthy no matter what you do. But you pick a few fish that you want to uses your males, and a few fish you want to use as females, put them together in a tank for a couple of weeks, then take the males out and put the females, you know, separately so that they're not in with the males anymore, and you kind of start the process over again. So it takes a lot of tank space. It takes a lot of diligence keeping the males, you know, as they're growing up, keeping them out of the females' tank so that you actually get females that have never mated yet until you decide which males you're going to use. That being the case, it takes a lot of effort. Now, you can still do some kind of informal selection just by removing males as you see them that you don't want to contribute to your gene pool and so on. But that takes a lot longer. It's a lot more haphazard, and you're not going to get as much progress as you would otherwise. So that's the very basic premise of guppy breeding, I guess you could say, that you need to operate on that and decide how big your project is going to be. But basically, at a minimum, you're going to need 4 tanks, and probably more than that. I would also say that in terms of which types to cross or how to achieve a consistent strain, part of that is what I just said. Inbreeding is going to be part of that. So you'll start selecting, you'll do crosses with siblings. You can do crosses, you know, cross good females back to a male and so on. That can help fix a strain. But inbreeding also brings negative consequences, and like fancy guppies in the hobby have been compromised to some extent by inbreeding, in that they're just weaker fish than they used to be. And so and I experimented with this when I was a kid, and we're talking, you know, I was 12, 13 years old when I started doing this, taking fancy guppy strains and putting wild type guppy strains in with them. I got a couple of really exceptional fish that way, and several generations after, you know, starting this, I got some really nice fish. But initially, a lot of the fish turned out really junky. Like, the first generation, most of the males had really awful tail shapes. They were terrible. Some of the colors were nice, and some of them were awful. But the fin shapes were inconsistent. They were asymmetrical. They were ragged looking. And not because there was any problem with, you know, the fish's health or damage to the fins. It's just genetically that's what came out. And it took me a few generations to get rid of that and get back to a more attractive fish, and I eventually did. And I came out with some really nice, like some top swords, bottom swords, and double swords, which were some of the ones that I like to focus on. But it took a long time, like I said. And I would say, think about this. Before you decide to fix your own strain, pick a strain you like, a nice, robust, healthy strain, if you can find one. And there are some out there. Find one that you really like, really appeals to you, and focus on breeding that for a while and getting really nice fish. Once you've done that and you feel like you're comfortable with doing it and you've decided that that's something you want to keep doing, then you can start selecting for your own strain and picking things to work with, I would say. You'll have a better idea of how to do it because you'll have some experience under your belt. That's my advice on that. Hopefully it's helpful. And if you have other questions about it, feel free to follow up. And thank you for contributing for listening to AquariumX, and thank you for contributing too. We welcome you officially as a new contributor.
Okay, should we go to Juliet?
Yeah.
In Paris, France. She said, "Dear Russ and Kelly, this mail should have been sent immediately following your request for us to give you our opinions about stopping the podcast. Unfortunately, I was sick, so I am only answering now. That's just fine. We're still happy to hear from you. Yours is one of the only podcasts on aquariums out there. I personally would love to have the time to watch everything on YouTube, but I don't, and I am not alone. I do have time for podcasts. Housework, shopping, public transport. Please, please, please do not stop it. I wait all week for it. This week I have some real newbie questions for you."
Okay, well, your opinion seems to be consistent with those of many people who have responded, so I think we're going to try to keep doing the podcast because people want it. And that's good. Mm-hmm. We're glad people want it. So, and we're also glad that we found out that part of the reason we weren't getting podcasts contributors is because there was a problem with the server.
Naughty thing.
That seems to have been resolved. So we feel better about that.
Oh, your tablet is also naughty. It just ate the
There
script.
It goes. Now there it's back.
Okay. Okay, she says, "This week I have some real newbie questions for you. How much is overfeeding? I can't follow the 5-minute rule. I have shrimp, bororas, and shy pygmy corys and habrosis. The pygmies can take half an hour before they even venture out. The shrimp take forever to eat. No matter what I put in, they eat it within a few hours, but I've had trouble with planaria in the past from overfeeding and want to avoid this in the future. In this tank, there are 4 Pygmy Corys, 4 Habrosis, 5 Rasbors, Brigitte, and 20 RSC red cherry shrimp. Yes. Mm-hmm. I will usually give a small pinch of fine flake, let's say about 10 big flakes ground up fine, for the Rasbors, and about a third of a sinking pellet. Because they are small fish, I feed them this amount twice a day. Is this too much or too little? Should I stick to twice a day or once? Or once a day for the pellet and twice for the flake? The Rasbors will only eat what floats in the water column and never what is on the floor. I wanted to give them a treat and brought back live tiny brine shrimp. Only two of the pygmies and the red cherry shrimp ate any. The Rasbors didn't even try. I tried bloodworms. The Rasbors love the smell but could only take tiny chopped bits. The Habrosis tried but gave up, and only the largest female pygmy cory ate any. Once again, the red cherry shrimp got the most. None of them will go near Daphnia. There's nothing worse than trying to siphon a whole batch of dying brine shrimp from a heavily planted nano. Thankfully, I still have a large population of ram's horns that clean up. It did teach me that Rasbor Brigitte are safe with baby shrimp. I have not seen them nose-to-nose with newborns.
No, she has seen them
nose-to-nose. Oh, sorry. I have seen them nose-to-nose with newborns, and they are not triggered by the movement at all. So that's good. What they are into is microfauna. Every time I shake the moss a bit or waft the larger plant leaves, you can see them gobbling up microorganisms. I really want to get some live food for my fish, but microworms seem to be the only solution. Problem is, I can't find any here. Are there any kinds of live food you can attract and breed yourself? My next project is to set up a 20-gallon only for coolie loaches and to try and breed them. I have about a chance in 100, but I have time. Well, here, maybe we should talk about the other one before I start on that.
Let's
go back to the feeding.
Okay. So a couple of things we could look at here. One is, I would suggest trying, if you are able to time-wise, try breaking up the feedings even more. So maybe give the same amount of food you're giving, if that seems to be working for you and you're not getting a lot of extra. And just break it up into 4 feedings a day. So if you're giving a small pinch of fine flake once a day, and it's 10 big flakes, try giving 4 smaller pinches 4 times a day, so 2.5 flakes each time, and see if that helps. See if it's getting it. Because I feel like there might be too much going on, actually. It's really easy to err on the side of too much. Especially red cherry shrimp don't need much food. And if they get too much, you know, if there's too much in there, it's not going to be good for the water quality. It's not going to be good for a lot of things. But they don't need as much food as they will go for, if that makes any sense. So I would say little and often, especially with these small fish, might help. Might help them take care of what's in the water column and leave less to fall on the ground. You do want the quarries to get some stuff, but that's of course what the sinking pellets are for, to a large extent. Also, I would say I wouldn't give up on the live brine shrimp yet. Sometimes fish need to see something a few times, so the Rasbors might eventually, you know, get in on the act and start eating them, but it might take a few times. And you mentioned that they liked the bloodworms. So if you were to toss in some baby brine shrimp along with a little bit of bloodworms, maybe the smell would get them excited and they would end up trying to eat a brine shrimp and finding out they like it. So that's a technique you could attempt and see if that works. I have had fish, even with live foods, go through a learning curve about what they like. And so
kind of like toddlers.
Right. And if you know they already like the bloodworms, just try that to get them in a feeding frenzy and introduce the shrimp at the same time. Try it a few times. See what you get. If it doesn't work, then you can always stop. But I would say trying that is good. And since you do have the ram's horns in there, they will help clean up the dying brine shrimp or the dead brine shrimp. It's interesting what you said about the microfauna. I would say that might mean you could try culturing something fairly large like rotifers or other very small organisms. Even try an infusoria culture and see if they like it, because they are really small fish. They might actually be interested in some of the larger specimens or creatures that would be found in an infusoria culture. Those are easy enough to do. You just take some tank water, you know, and put it in with some organic matter in a jar in a sunny window and let it go for a week or two. Let the bacterial bloom happen. Let that clear up a little bit. And then, you know, I've ended up culturing organisms that way that are large enough to be seen with the naked eye if you have really good eyes. Not large enough to see what they are, but to see them moving around in little clouds, and you can see the individual creatures moving. And then that might well be something that would be interesting to them and that you could already get because you already have some in your microphone in your tank. So just you'd be vastly increasing the numbers of them, and that might be a good way to do live food. Microworms, I think, is a great suggestion, or banana worms or Walter worms. If you can't find any there, I'm going to send this out to aquariumaxers in Europe because I don't really understand the laws for shipping things between countries in Europe, but it seems to me from what I've read and heard that it's a little more relaxed. It's easier to get like live foods, for example, from England to France than it is to get them from France to the US or whatever.
So when we lived in Hawaii, we couldn't, even though it was technically part of the US, we couldn't get them shipped in.
It was pretty hard to get anything in. Yeah, we weren't allowed to, so it didn't work. But if anyone there, anywhere in Europe, has shipped things to other countries in Europe, but specifically shipped live foods into France successfully, if you can give us some feedback on that, it would be nice to know if we could get some, someone could get some microworms to Juliet in France. They're great. I have used microworms for so many small fish. Great for celestial pearl danios, for example, which are going to be kind of similar to your Boraras, and I think that might be a great way to go if you can get them. And think about the infusoria culture. Might be worth trying. Some people have mentioned using a potato trap to catch microworms or similar nematodes. You drill a 1-inch hole in a potato buried in the ground in moist soil in like a foresty sort of area or something like that, or under a tree. Pull it out after a week, scrape out the inner lining of that potato and put it in a microworm culture essentially and see if you get any of the nematodes to breed for you. I have never successfully done it, but I think it would probably be worth a try. So if you can't get any, it's probably worth a try doing that. Here in the desert, it's probably not going to be as effective. All right, so those are some ideas that you can use to hopefully bring some live food to your fish. Let us know how that goes. Let's go on to your next project.
Okay, she says, my next project is to set up a 20-gallon only for coolie loaches and to try and breed them. I have about a chance in 100, but I have time. I wanted the substrate to be dark, but apparently all dark sands are sharp. I have been told to use sand, but also that the few lucky breeders recommend gravel to encourage them to lay. What do you suggest? Are aqua soils okay for corys and coolies, or despite being rounded, are they too rough? My current corys are on aqua soil and have not lost their barbels. And I'm just going to say again, I'm pretty sure I've said it, but barbel is fun to say. Barbel, barbel, barbel. It's like the Jabberwocky.
It kind of is.
Yeah, barbel, barbel, barbel. Okay, sorry. Is there a dark substrate that is soft enough? In many YouTube videos, I see corys on large gravel. I thought large gravel collected too much bacteria. I would love your ideas. All my best from Parish France, Juliet.
All right, well, let's talk about this a bit. I have had coolie loaches on various substrates. I had a group of coolies on a dark substrate that I ended up taking them off of because I felt like it was too sharp. As you mentioned, it was also rather messy because in their flurry and, you know, kicking around in the
digging,
in the substrate, the digging, they tended to make the substrate, make the detritus just fly up into the water column, and the filter wasn't up to keeping all of it out, and so it was kind of messy. I ended up replacing it with gravel. I also found out that the sand was, I believe it was Tahitian moon sand, was kind of sharp. It didn't damage their barbels that I could see, but I just didn't feel comfortable having them on it. So I put them on gravel, black gravel later. I would say, I remember Juliet has told us that she once accidentally bred a coolie loach. Accidentally bred coolie loaches. She found in a tank with coolie loaches in it one small fry that had hatched.
A wee little baby.
Yep. And I'm not entirely sure I haven't. Because sometimes when I counted my coolie loaches, I felt like there were more in there than there had been before. And, you know, it may have happened. It's hard to tell. Anyway, a couple of things that I can point out, perhaps, even though I've never bred Culiloches, that I have seen videos on YouTube, and maybe you've seen some of the same videos, that at least black Culiloches, and I'm not sure which species or type you're interested in breeding, will breed in fairly hard water, and they will also breed over large gravel, like riverstone size gravel, where the almost pebbles size. And that what happens is they'll spawn, and the eggs will fall down in between the pebbles into places where the Culiloches themselves, the adults, cannot go, and so the eggs remain unmolested, whereas on other substrates, the eggs would be exposed to their predation, basically. So that's an interesting thing to think about. I'm not sure about aqua soils. I would say if they're rounded and the fish are getting enough to eat, you're probably okay. What some people have done, I believe, is they've put a saucer, like a terracotta plant saucer for use under a terracotta plant pot, put one of those on one side of the tank and fed them on that, and the rim, you know, prevents some of the food from falling down in between the gaps in the gravel, which helps maintain the water quality, but the eggs can fall into the interstices between the pebbles. And so that may be something to look at, something to pursue. I think if I were to do it, that's how I would set up the tank. I would either have, you know, maybe a third of the tank would be the river stones, the larger ones, with the gaps where the Culiloches couldn't get down to the bottom. And then the rest of the tank would have maybe a flat terracotta tray where I would feed them, and then just normal gravel or maybe sand. And then chances are, if they're going to spawn, some of the eggs will fall down into the gravel, and the fry hopefully would be able to survive, and I would at least see if they're there, and if so, I could probably get micworms and other foods down to them. But it seems to have worked for some people, though, and they successfully find all kinds of fry are maturing down in the little gaps there in the gravel, and there's apparently enough food down there for them to do okay. So, now again, this was with black Culiloches, so I don't know what you're looking at doing. And if you're doing the other Culiloches, by most accounts, you're going to need to have softer water. But things to consider. Hopefully that's helpful.
Yep.
In other news, let's see.
Do we have any other news?
Well, I do want to report, because I'm still excited about it, that my Daphnia are doing well. The colonies are growing. I've got two buckets set up. I think I mentioned that last time. And they're breeding. They're reproducing pretty quickly. So now I have, I don't know, I might have as many as 100 Daphnia now. So pretty soon there's going to be a really large population explosion. I'll have thousands of them, and I'll be able to feed them out to my fish, and I'll be able to sell them, and so on. So pretty excited that that worked after having thought that they were gone, being 99% sure that they weren't going to make it, and that 1% paid off. So just leaving it there in the off chance that it might work.
The first one
was successful.
Burned down.
And then sank into the swamp.
But the fourth one stayed up.
Yeah, you never know.
So these are the staying up Daphnia.
Yep.
Hope but they just springs want eternal to in the Daphnia sing.
Bucket. Oh, none of that.
None of that.
Anyway, I think that's all for now, ladies and gentlemen.
Wait.
Oh, we have something else.
Well, it's not aquatic.
Oh, well, tell us anyway.
And it's in a Rubbermaid instead of a tank. I don't remember if we talked about it last week.
I can think of a tenuous connection to fish, so go ahead.
Did we talk about it last week?
I don't remember.
I don't remember. Sorry if we did. But we got baby chickens.
We did.
They're so cute and fluffy.
We have 10 baby chickens, and it's fun. We're enjoying them.
They're adorable.
And we're excited for eggs.
Yes, they will be tasty. The eggs, not the chickens.
No, we're not going to eat the chickens, just the eggs.
Chickens will have a happy life in our backyard with plenty of room to run around and scratch in the dirt and eat bugs.
And grass. And whatever else they want to eat.
Stuff.
And here's the connection. They've done studies. Chickens that are allowed to eat things outside and, you know, eat grass and whatnot have higher concentrations of omega-3 fatty acids in their eggs and certain vitamins and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be healthier eggs. Those healthy eggs make a good emergency fry food.
Oh, you can hard boil the yolk.
Yeah, you hard boil the yolk and then you kind of press it through a fine, like a muslin or a brine shrimp net. And just release a little bit into your aquarium water. It's a great emergency fry food for tiny egg layers. It works well for live bears too. They'll eat it up as well. And that those fresh eggs with the higher concentrations of omega-3 fatty acids are good for your fry. I have raised surprise spawns of danios and white clouds and various things on that egg yolk for the first week or so. And by that time, they're big enough to start eating other things like microworms. Works like a charm. So there's a connection to fish.
And they're just really cute.
We've been looking forward to raising our own chickens for a long time.
For a long time.
And we are now doing it. So we are excited.
Maybe we should post a picture of the chickens just for fun.
Just for fun, we could probably do that. So, other than that, I think we're just about ready to sign off. So,
yep. May the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. To leave comments or questions that could be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.